Brew Nation, welcome to episode 799 of Random Musings from the Clinical Charles Guru. In this episode, I go solo and I discuss what the most common mistakes that clinical research coordinators make. It's something that is very important that I've learned over the years, that I've kind of learned the hard way, and I try to distill it all in under 30 minutes. So hopefully you enjoy. Really quick shout out to my sponsors. First one is Inato. Inato, I just got another text this morning. This study might be appropriate for you. I click, I ask my cardiologist. Sure enough, it is. It's free. It doesn't cost me anything. I've already been matched and gotten site selections and initiations and actually gotten studies out of it. They don't get involved in the budget. It's free. I highly recommend you check it out. It is also useful. It is also for experienced therapeutic area sites. But if you are, you can't go wrong there. Check out Inato. Next sponsor is Creo. Creo, I just got off of it this morning as well. I'm scheduling a patient. One of my patients wanted to come in another day. I went in there, clicked a button, rescheduled the visit. They'll get an auto text reminder. My staff will know because their calendars will be updated. It's so much more than just eSource. It's CTMS, it's eRegulatory, it's eSignatures, it's eConsent, it's texting, it's a database. You pay what you use and nothing more. So check that out. Hopefully you enjoyed this episode. The mistakes, most common mistakes coordinators make. Let me know if I'm missing anything. Catch you later. Bye-bye.
Guru Nation, thank you so much for watching. Make sure you like, subscribe, comment, share. Look, this is like the most common mistakes coordinators make, whether they're experienced, whether they're new. Of course, the more experienced ones supposed to make these mistakes less often. But this is through my observations, not just as a site director for like 20 years, soon to be, but also as like a former CRA. And then I've ran this by a few of our CRA colleagues of mine. So, Robert Goldman, who used to be a CRA, various people I've interviewed on the podcast that used to be CRAs, Tiffany Bennett, who's our CRA Academy instructor. And they've basically validated these things. And I'm going to start with like the most serious ones first, because there's a lot of minor things like, oh, you forgot to fill out headers. And that's for the people who use PaperSource and not eSource. With eSource, you don't need to worry about headers ever again. My staff, they don't even know what PaperSource is. They don't need to worry about headers. But I mean, those are minor things, right? But I'm talking about like major things. I'm going to start out first. Whenever an informed consent is amended, so usually when a protocol has an amendment, has a change, it usually triggers an informed consent amendment. And we're going to come back to this protocol amendment because this move, which happens like three or four times on average every study, triggers a lot of mistakes. So the first thing I've noticed, and literally we're going through this right now at Yuma Clinical Trials with my staff. All three studies that we're enrolling for, all three have had protocol amendments and ICF amendments in the last month. Because I know this, I am on them about, hey, make sure you get the ICF, the latest version of the informed consent signed. Not just for the new patients, because they usually know that. Like at a screening, you have to get an informed consent, right? That's the first step. And then people will check, stop and think, hopefully, where's the new amendment? Another mistake is if they use the old informed consent for a new screening. That's obviously a huge issue. But normally what happens from my experiences is when a new amendment occurs, all the patients that are currently in a particular study need to re-sign the informed consent. And typically, especially at the beginning of like the new informed consent being published or being approved by the IRB, that very next patient visit, whomever it may be, that's the one where the mistakes might happen. And if you're a good monitor or a good site director or you have a good QA system in place, you will catch it, or you will proactively like preempt this from occurring, but missing that signing the new informed consent form for an existing subject at their next visit. So for example, if an IRB approved a new informed consent on March 24th, and they actually published it and sent it to the sites March 24th, and a patient comes in March 25th for a study, and they're already in the trial, a lot of times those coordinators forget because it's so new and it just happened, and sometimes they miss the memo, that they'll let that visit go without reobtaining the informed consent on the new version. That's a deviation. And that's actually a major deviation because it's a, and for any informed consent, deviation is considered a patient safety issue. So you got to have a good QA system in place. This is why e-consent is helpful, because if you have a system like Creo, you can populate, or someone can populate at the site, the latest version, which will pop up in the informed consent when it's triggered, but it won't preempt the coordinator to remember to do it. It'll just load it for the new patients. So for the existing patients, if you're the site director or the lead CRC or the CRC at your site, you need to be very paranoid about this thing. This happens a lot. And like I said, my site right now, three of our trials in the last month have all amended the informed consent. And I had to remind the staff multiple times, make sure, did this patient sign it? Did this one sign it? When is this one coming in? Now, there are exceptions. Like I said, if the IRB sent the form, let's say they approved it March 24th and they notified the sites or they published it on the IRB portal, like let's say they published it at like 2 p.m. and the patient came on March 24th, but at 9 a.m., that's not a deviation because the site technically did not have access to that form yet. But if you have access to that form, and I've seen this happen sometimes right when the visit's about to end, patient's still there, someone needs to run that informed consent over because you're trying to prevent deviations. Now, if it's the same day, sometimes it's understandable. Hey, site wasn't made aware until after patient left. That's fine. But if it's the next day or like a week later that the patient comes in and the informed consent, the new informed consent was not done, that's a system issue. That's a process issue that probably will require a CAPA plan, which is a corrective action, preventative action. So just please be hypervigilant about this particular aspect and most of the other ones I'm going to cover today. Super important. All right. The next one. And by the way, one more thing. Once the informed consent's amended and sent to the sites, you do not need to call your patients in for an unscheduled visit just to sign the form. You can wait till their next scheduled visit. But if they do come in for an unscheduled visit for any reason, they should sign it, right? So you don't. It's not an emergency to get them back in, but on their next available visit, their next scheduled visit, they should reconsent. And you should document this process in a progress note. So it's not enough to just get the form signed. I mean, that's great. You got to document the process of consent again. Even if it's visit 5 or visit 23, it doesn't matter. Document in the progress notes, process of consent. Let's move on. Protocol amendments trigger a lot of stuff. So another thing a protocol amendment will do, oftentimes, you have to look at what's been amended. Luckily, a lot of sponsors do like a summary of changes. So you don't have to actually read the entire protocol again to figure out and compare it to the old one to figure out what's changed. They do that reading for you, they being the sponsor. They'll send you a summary of changes. And then you make sure, does any of this require me to revise my source? Maybe instead of 2 blood pressures, they want 3 blood pressures. Or maybe instead of 1 ECG reading at a certain visit, they want 3. Or maybe instead of no PK draws at visit 6, they want 1. Or maybe instead of 22 visits in a study, there's now going to be 32 visits in a study. I've literally had that one happen to us recently. I'm still not sure actually how that one affects our budget, but I'm hoping that we're going to find out about that soon. Luckily, the budget doesn't draw protocol deviations, but that's a side note. That's another topic. So you might need to revise your source. So make sure you do that, and then make sure you're using the new version of the source. So if you're using paper source, on the bottom, on the footer, somewhere, you need to make note that this is the newest version of the source. If you're using Creo, it'll just automatically update. If you have to go in and do it, but someone has to go in and configure it, but then all the versions are updated for you automatically, which is pretty cool. So why do you need to update the source? Because if the protocol said you got to do this now, which is new, or you should not do this anymore, which is new, and you haven't changed your source, at whatever next visit that's going to occur, if you're going by the old source, most likely the coordinator is going to follow the source. And they might be following an incorrect source. And now that's a protocol deviation. And that's probably a big deviation too, because a lot of those changes come due to patient safety reasons, or at least making like the study easier for patients. Sometimes that's the case. But a lot of times it's like new safety information, like, hey, we actually want to get a PK draw, or we want to get a third ECG reading instead of just one. We want to get triplicates. Those are patient safety issues, and those are all IRB reportable. And what happens when a site reports too many deviations to an IRB and they become outliers? It could trigger not only an IRB audit, but the IRB can send it over to their friends at the FDA and say, hey, we're noticing some unusual activity here from one of our sites. So, I mean, try to avoid these kind of things if you can, right? You don't want an FDA audit because an IRB told them you're an outlier. That doesn't guarantee an audit, but it definitely increases the probability of your site getting audited. Another thing that protocol amendments usually require is a training log. So protocol's been changed. How do we document that everyone at the site understood the changes? It usually comes in the form of a training log for the amended protocol. And there's no way to say in research, if it's not documented, it didn't happen. So there's no way of saying, yeah, we're all trained on it, let's move on, without documenting it on a log somehow. Whether it's a paper log or electronic log, whatever your site's processes are, it should be done, and it should be done contemporaneously, meaning if the protocol was amended, it should be that week, and it really should be before the next patient visit to which those changes become applicable. So it should be done in real time. And I know, because I used to monitor, a lot of sites don't have updated training logs because they don't have a QA system in place. At our site, we do. I'm still in that role to some extent, but I'm trying to transition it to the actual system we have, where the lead CRC and the QA specialist are on top of these things. But when you're a newer site, the staff are newer too, including the lead CRCs and including the QA specialist. So someone's still got to watch it, in my opinion, and that's the protocol training log. Now, another thing that often comes up, that a finding that I see, finally, one that doesn't have anything to do with protocol amendments, is out-of-window visits. And a lot of times, I mean, it's technically a deviation, but it's usually not a deviation that affects patient safety. So that's a good thing. They're usually not IRB reportable. But out-of-window visits happen sometimes because the patients can't make it on time. Hey, I'm on vacation this week, so I'm going to have to do next week. We just had a patient who's out-of-window by like 3 days because they couldn't come in last week. They came in this week, and now they have their next visit coming up like 2 days after their last visit because they're going to run out of IP. They're going to run out of drug. So we're doing 2 visits in a week when they were supposed to be done 2 visits in 2 weeks. And one of those was out of window. Now, that was one that the site had no control over, right? We can't force the patient to come in when they can't. But what I've noticed, and my site included, which is why I got to stay on top of people, is following the scheduling the next patient visit before the patient leaves the site for the current visit. So it's very tempting when you're busy, the patient's busy, the patient wants to get out of here. Hey, I'm going to let you know when your next visit is. I'll call you later or we'll text you later. Well, what often happens there is you get busy and you forget to schedule it. And then what reminds you is either you have a good system like Creo, which will tell you, hey, patient's overdue, or more likely what happens is an IRT system will send you an email saying, hey, patient is out of window. And the coordinator will get that email and say, huh, what is this? And then they'll look in their records and they'll say, oh, you know what? We forgot to schedule this patient's next visit. And then what happens is you scramble to call the patient and you say, hey, can you come in today or can you come in tomorrow? You're going to be out of window. And it's not like the patient knows what that is. And what if the patient can't? So now you're causing a deviation, usually not patient safety related, but if you're missing their investigational product, like if they run out of investigational product, then it does become a patient safety issue. And it also becomes a protocol compliance issue that does affect patient safety because you ran out of medications for the patient. Every study, most studies, they have a built-in out-of-window surplus of investigational product that the patients usually get. But if you exceed those, then you got to scramble to get the patient back in, and you don't want missed doses because you forgot or you didn't have time to schedule a patient. So always a practice I have at my site, always schedule their next visit before they leave their current visit. Now, the only visit you can't do this on is screening, because at screening, you don't know if the patient qualifies, so you don't know when their next visit actually is, if there ever will be one. And this leads me to my next common mistake I see newer sites and experienced sites make a lot, is not communicating properly during the screening period. There is a huge temptation for sites when a patient screen fails to register it in the IRT, patient screen failed, to document it in the notes, patient screen failed due to this criteria not being met. But they forget the simple human element of letting the patient know, hey, unfortunately, you did not pass this study. This is why. We do have other studies lined up for you in the future if you're interested. If you want a copy of your lab results, feel free to come in and we'll give you a copy. But you got to keep this communication line open with patients. So make it a habit. Even when they screen fail, let them know why they screen failed. Or another common thing I see during screening, so that's a mistake, is there's usually another assessment the patient has to do. So for example, one of our studies, we screen them, and then if they're diabetic, we have to schedule an eye exam for them. But we won't schedule an eye exam for them because it costs us money until we know that their lab values are within inclusion-exclusion range. So we'll get the lab values, they're normal, but then scheduling the eye exam falls through the cracks because we're busy with other patients. And then someone remembers, hey, why is this patient still in screening? We're going to run out of screening window. Oh, well, they still have to do an eye exam. And then after that, we got to get the results. And now you're basically going out of window to randomize. Now, again, out of window stuff, they are deviations. Usually not a big deal. But in some studies, and I have one study right now, and this actually did affect us. I have one study where the patient, they did not allow any out-of-window randomizations. They were very strict. You have to randomize within 21 days of screening, no exceptions at all, including when we were screening patients during the holiday. Luckily for us, they allowed rescreenings in that study. So we screen failed two people because of this. We got to rescreen them after the holidays in the new year. And we actually forgot to schedule their eye exams. And then it was the holiday. And then the eye exam people were on vacation. And there was no way we were going to get all that scheduled and the results back prior to that visit window. So someone's got to be hypervigilant at the site about walking a patient through from screening to baseline. Super important. Luckily for you site owners, you have every incentive to do so, because a randomized patient is worth a lot more than a screen failed patient. So the sites have this incentive aligned properly, in my opinion, but it still falls through the crack. Another common mistake: letting patients screen fail themselves based on patient-reported outcome answers. I've witnessed this personally twice in the last quarter, and it cost us probably, if you count in the entire completed patient of 40 grand, it cost us 80 grand. Patient, on one scale, I'm not going to mention what it was, scored too high, and then they submitted on site, but no one was supervising them of what they're doing. They left them alone in a room with a tablet and said, hey, complete this scale. And when you're done, we're going to continue with the next steps. They even let them know the study wants these kind of scores. You know, they kind of gave them like hints, and the patient didn't listen, because when we brought it up, like, they failed themselves. We couldn't do anything at that point. They already put too high of a score on a patient-reported outcome. The system failed them. We had to screen fail them. And when we told the patient, hey, is this what you meant to put? They said, no, I was just in a hurry and putting numbers down. So if you have to, babysit your patients. Like, someone sit in the room with them and make sure they're doing it properly. And this is probably one of the hardest things to be compliant with as a site, because there's a fine line between coaching a patient and telling them what to put versus making sure that the answers they are putting in the patient reported outcome is actually reflective of what they want to put, and not just them clicking things to get to the next page. Because I've seen this mistake happen now in the last quarter twice. And that one really pisses me off. It pisses off the patient too, because they said, oh, if I would have known, I wouldn't have done that. And we're like, yeah, but we let you know. The problem was, we didn't sit there and babysit you. So letting patients screen fail themselves is another big one. Another big one is missing initials or dates written incorrectly on the informed consent. So another ICF issue that I see a lot, and the coordinator's not checking that was missed. Like, all the places where the initial should be, and also having legible writing on the informed consent. And I know e-consent fixes this, but e-consent also depends on the system. You can miss initials and things like that too. We've made this mistake on both mediums, paper and electronic e-consent. So, common mistake, legibility issues occur. You're supposed to teach patients how to correct, like, when they write a wrong date. Oftentimes, I just saw one, actually. It was March 22nd, 2024, and the patient wrote it. They dated on the bottom of every page March 22nd, 24, but on one page, because they were doing it fast, they put March 24, 22. They flipped it, and no one caught it. And when I caught it, I let the staff know, hey, you should put a note to file. Patient inadvertently wrote this when it's clear that it's March 22nd, 2024. But you're supposed to catch that in the moment and have the patient strike out the error, initial and date it, and rewrite the correct error. I know it's annoying. I know patients hate it. Coordinators hate it too. You know who doesn't hate it is the FDA. The FDA wants to see that you're doing these things properly as far as documentation is concerned. I think that's most of it, like the operational stuff, or at least the source documentation stuff. There's obviously a lot of like regulatory stuff, not getting labs signed on time, not having the PI check clinically significant on all the lab results. I mean, there's a lot more mistakes. This can take an hour. Those are important as well. But these are the main ones. Not printing the labs off in time to prior to randomization, not getting the PI to sign the labs prior to randomization, not getting the PI to review labs prior to the next scheduled visit. Those are big deals. Another one is not getting the PI to look at things regularly and sign things and have a PI footprint. That's important as a coordinator that you make sure your PI has a footprint over the study. Another thing, and this one is more general, responding to patient leads. So patients that are interested in your trials. I know we get busy. We're super busy at YCT. This is why I might hire an admin to do this. Is responding to patient leads in a timely manner, meaning ideally same day, ideally same hour. And I know even same day is tough for a lot of sites. And I know a lot of sites don't even do it at all. So that's unfortunate, but hopefully your site's not one of those sites. And also responding back like in a timely manner to your CRAs. So for example, during study startup, we're having a new asthma study getting started. Shout out to one of our sponsors here in Otto. We just had a site selection visit today. Our monitor thanked us, all the staff, for getting the documents to them quickly. Like in one day, we sent back all the documents that they wanted. And I made it a point. I prioritized that. I said, we have to make sure we do this. I know it's a short timeline, but there's five of us. Each of you take a form or two and complete it, get the PI to sign it. I went to get the PI to sign it with Lana today. The monitor was super happy that we were able to do that. So those are some of the more minor mistakes that don't really involve patient safety, but reflect on the quality of your site in general. So hopefully this video helps. I hope there's something in here for everyone. Share it with a friend or a colleague. Like, subscribe, comment, share. Bye-bye.